Good evening. My name is Herb and I'm an alcoholic. Perhaps even good morning for some of our international guests. Please join me in prayer for an open mind. God, please set aside everything that I think I know about myself, my brokenness, the 12 steps, and you, for an open mind and a new experience of myself, my brokenness, the 12 steps, and especially you. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Well, at long last, we're going to be looking at step one, truly beginning in the step work, as I've indicated. It's really important, I believe, to you, not to me, but to you, that you really embrace the set-aside attitude. Whether you use these words or not, that's your choice. You'll notice that this particular prayer has not a reference to the 12 steps. It's my generic prayer for anybody who's just interested in a spiritual path, regardless of whether it's connected to the 12 steps. I do believe at 10 years of sobriety that it was the suggestion for an attitude shift, letting go of my prior experience, letting go of my prior knowledge, being open to being delivered to a place that I don't control, I don't anticipate, I don't expect. And I'm asking you, challenging you, inviting you to pray that prayer, some form of it, or whether it's just a positive affirmation and it's not necessarily a prayer, depending on your own belief system, to have an open mind and open heart, knowing that it's beyond my capability, it's beyond each of your capabilities to actually make it so open, sufficiently willing and open. And we don't know where we're blocked, and we don't know how we're blocked, and we don't know that we're blocked. The model that I use that's come to me after three different journeys through the steps of what a human being is. Now, certainly, I have lots of philosophical background. I studied to be a Catholic priest for 7 years in a monastery that was based on a particular philosophy, the Greek philosophy of Aristotle. I'm sure that's where part of my organization came from in terms of human development, philosophical, the underpinnings of many thinkers over history. Then I studied psychology, which actually reinforced this model. I didn't know it at the time. And then I did the steps progressively. I didn't know that I was doing them progressively. I came in February 21st, 1984. If you're paying attention, then this Sunday is my 37th anniversary. Yeah, that's wonderful. It's great. It was a real gift because I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I didn't join AA, and I didn't decide to quit drinking. I stopped drinking to support my wife's recovery because the hospital asked me to. That was February 20th. They asked me to stop. February 21st is my first day without alcohol. The story between then and my first meeting of AA 3 months later is a story for a different day. But that did begin my journey. When they asked me to quit drinking to support her recovery, not because they knew I had a problem. They might have suspected it, but they never mentioned that. that willingness to attend the hospital program, that willingness to listen to their suggestions and to take the actions that they suggested, even though I didn't know why and what they were talking about and what the reasoning was behind it. Normally things that I would have really challenged. And then as I got into the program in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a sponsor because they said to. I was willing to do that. I attended meetings because he said he wanted me to do that. I thought I worked the steps when he said, work the steps, read the big book. And I did it on my own without any help from anybody else because, don't you know, I'm reasonably intelligent, fairly well educated, and I read English quite well. Thank you. He never offered help. I never asked for help. I did a fourth step that was an autobiographical fourth step, a script, my story, no analysis, no in-depth, no insight, just a story that I thought was true. And I did my ninth step on that basis. I'm saying it this way because I really want you to get that I had a very feeble start, feeble in the sense that it didn't have any substance to it. I worked all the 12 steps in my first year of recovery, and I did not change. And I went to a meeting every day, and I called my sponsor every day for 10 years. And I went to step studies, and I went to book studies. But then the first time I worked the steps was with a man who asked me to do the doctor's opinion, which is what we're going to do tonight. And I finished the steps based on his specific direction out of the big book. I had no further experience with the first step. I had no experience with steps 2 and 3. I had a big experience with step 4. We can talk about that some other time. I believe that's when my spiritual awakening started. I didn't know it at the time. I finished those steps and I was radically changed. It took 12 months. After I finished the ninth step, I was aware. I became aware, not during, but after I finished the ninth step, I became aware that I had been radically changed. Radically, at the root level. Radix is the Latin word. And I stayed with that for about 3 years until I had other problems and I decided to go through the steps again. This time the man gave me what I consider to be different instructions, or at least I heard them differently with regard to step 1, addiction. And I saw that I have a problem of the mind, an obsession that is a delusion. We're going to spend a month on it, so you don't need to know what I'm talking about or learn what I'm talking about or record what I'm talking about. You will have an experience of going through the big book and looking at what Bill says about the problem of the mind, the insanity that Bill means, not the insanity that you hear about in the 12-step rooms, but what the big book says about insanity. The defect of the mind, the inherent defect of the mind of an alcoholic, and broadening it to the addict. And then the third time I went through the steps 3 years later, 1994, this is the man that at 10 years of sobriety gave me the set aside attitude and prayer and introduced me to the second half of step 1, unmanageability. I had no clue that unmanageability was separate from addiction. I had no knowledge of what unmanageability meant. I had no understanding of how it manifests in our lives. And I got all of that journey through the steps. And we'll spend a month looking at that. We'll be in step 1 for about 2 to 3 months as we go through the big book, looking at each aspect of what I've just illustrated there on the PowerPoint. What's wrong with my body? That's the doctor's opinion. What's wrong with my mind? That's Bill Wilson's experience. What's wrong with my willpower? I do what I don't want to do and I don't do what I want to do. That's a summary of unmanageability. That's a summary of the spiritual malady. That's the crucial problem. Addiction is not the problem. Take a breath. Addiction is not the problem. The big book suggests that, supports that in a couple different areas. I think it's page 64 and page 102. It says bottles are only a symbol. Alcohol is merely a symptom of our problem. The real problem is unmanageability. The real problem is the spiritual malady. Bill supports that in the big book. You haven't looked at this yet, but you may want to between now and next week, if you're interested, on page 64. Bill says, from resentment stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have been not only mentally and physically ill. Notice, body and mind. That's the addiction problem. We have been spiritually sick. That's the unmanageability problem. When the spiritual malady is overcome, unmanageability, we straighten out mentally and physically. Maybe that's why when we looked at step 10, where it says we enter the world of the spirit, Bill says we're placed in a position of neutrality with regard to our addiction, but we're not cured of our unmanageability. We have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So step one is the foundation. Bill uses that metaphor beginning in step two. I'm introducing it here because it's a wonderful concept and picture or graph in our minds. On page 47, in step two, Bill says, willingness is the cornerstone to a spiritual arch through which we walk to a new freedom. He hasn't suggested prior to that that there is an arch and or a foundation to that arch. So we read between the lines as a big book literalist and fundamentalist in the best of senses. If we're building an arch, there must be a foundation. Oh, if the cornerstone placed on the foundation is step two, it's probable that step one is the foundation. He carries that image into step three, where he calls step three the keystone, the stone at the top of the arch that holds the entire arch together, on page 62 or 63. And then he continues with the metaphor in at the conclusion of step five on page 75. Now we have walked through the arch, the spiritual arch to freedom. There's a set of promises there. Well, if we've got a foundation and we've got a cornerstone and we've got a keystone, and now at the end of the fifth step, we're walking through a built arch, what are the building blocks? Bill doesn't talk about it, but I'm in a deductive reasoning mechanism when I'm looking at the big book this way, trying to figure out a completion. Oh, maybe the building blocks are the building blocks of step four, resentment and fear and dishonesty as manifested in our unhealthy sexual behavior, because those are the three major components of step four. That model of body, mind, and will serves us really well in step one to understand step one. It will serve us even better in step two and three to really understand and experience step three. And then as I have an overview and perspective on the entire process, building the arch and walking through it, that model will hold for each step, but all of the steps together. And I'm spending some time on it because I will be referring to it regularly. Maybe each workshop we'll be talking about body, mind, and will, maybe focusing on one component or the other, but still that's the model I'm using. I mentioned that addiction is not the problem. That's correct, but it is a problem. The professionals today talk about substance and or process. And you can see several listed there of substance addiction, of course, alcohol, drugs, and food. Everything else there, and there's 100 others, are process addiction. We'll look at the doctor's opinion, and now there's some science that indicates there's a problem with the liver of an alcoholic. The liver doesn't process alcohol like normal people. It's pretty clear that it's genetic, and it's pretty clear that the other addictions, including the substance addictions of drugs and food, might be a genetic problem having its roots in brain chemistry or brain organization. Certainly the process addictions are brain malfunctions. Although there's not a lot of science and confirmation of that as I understand it. So this is one of my favorite cartoons that I plagiarized from the New Yorker magazine from probably 50 years ago. I don't read the New Yorker magazine. I happened to be in a doctor's office when I saw it probably. And when I was attempting to communicate some of the work in the step journey, it came to me. Pathetic herb in the bondage of addiction. I couldn't see that until, in fact, I saw the bondage of addiction after doing the steps two or three times. I saw the problem of the body and I saw the problem of the mind. But then at 10 years of sobriety, as I mentioned, I saw the problem of the spirit. I saw the problem of my will. I saw the problem of unmanageability, and Bill calls it the spiritual malady. And it's every bit a bondage. In fact, Bill calls it the bondage of self. We're powerless over alcohol. Substitute the word addiction. This group here is open to anybody with a addiction problem or a possible addiction problem. But it's also open to anybody without an addiction problem, because unmanageability has a dash before it. It's not I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. Of course, when I'm in my addiction, whatever it is, my life will be unmanageable. But here I am, 37 years sober. And today I'm totally convinced that on my own power, my life is unmanageable. I saw it in Technicolor at 10 years of sobriety, and I had been clean of alcohol, mind-altering anything, for 10 years. Unmanageability was in Technicolor. As I said before, I did what I did not want to do, and I didn't do what I wanted to do, despite my knowledge and despite all of the spiritual awakenings I had had prior to that moment. I had a problem with my body, that's clear. It's an allergy, an obsession, Dr. Silkworth says. And we're going to spend some time looking specifically at the doctor's opinion tonight. He's a psychiatrist. Dr. Silkworth is an MD with a specialty training in psychoanalytic theory. He wasn't very good at it. That's why he had to go to work for Towns Hospital in New York. He couldn't get a successful practice together for whatever reason. I don't know the background. But he's a very qualified man, a medical doctor with a psychiatric training. So we called them a psychiatrist. And he ran the drug and alcohol treatment program of Towns Hospital. It was a general hospital with a department that Silkworth ran. And his conclusion, as we'll see in his own opinion, is entire abstinence. For an alcoholic, of course, that's not going to be true for a food addict. You can't have entire abstinence. That's why we have several discussions about the difficulty of the different addictions. I look forward to hearing from the process addiction people, especially the people in Al-Anon. What's the parallel phenomenon here? What's the parallel vocabulary to use? And it's interesting. It's the first level of an experience with powerlessness. What does that mean, powerless? You see, it's in the title, and we could mouth it regularly. Oh, I'm powerless. People, places, and things, people say, thoughtlessly. When you examine that, it makes no sense. People, places, yes. Places, really? What? Things, really? What? No, we're powerless over our addiction. We're certainly powerless over people. We're certainly powerless over circumstances. Pay attention to your vocabulary. What does powerless mean? In order to give it some juice, pick a different word. We become brain dead to powerless. The word is used so often, like the word love. I love coffee. I love my dog. I love my wife. I love my children. I love driving. I love my car. Those are 15 to 20 different definitions of love. What does it mean? And we become brain dead to the word because we use it so often in so many ways. Powerless. No choice. The doctor's opinion says, once I put it in my system, no choice. But Bill says, well, if that were the only problem, then just stop. And of course, we are very capable of stopping regularly. We stop for a weekend, we stop for a week, we stop for a month, we stop for a year, we stop for 10 years. But the mind has a very similar defect to the body. Bill calls it insane. He doesn't mean psychiatric and psychological. Again, set aside, please. I'm going to challenge you in the discussion on Dr. Silkworth to really set aside allergy. What does it mean? Craving. What does it mean? Insane. What does it mean? It doesn't mean what's in the dictionary. The big book has a unique, peculiar, completely separate definition of those words. Part of it, what we'll look at, is an obsession. Our mind is defective in that it's vulnerable to a thought, and that thought is an obsession. The problem with the thought is that the content of it is a delusion. It's a lie. And of course, we have Frank Buchman, who was the Lutheran minister who started the Oxford Group, who created the six steps that helped those people who were in the organization of Oxford Group, first century Christianity, conversion orientation, to have that transformation in their mind and in their personalities. That's what Bill Wilson had the experience of, the six steps, as we've mentioned from the unpacking of the forwards last week. But the real problem was sourced by Dr. Jung, Carl Jung, because he said to Roland Hazard, go find a spiritual experience. He didn't say a religion. He actually didn't say a relationship with God. He said, go find a spiritual experience. And we'll look at deeply, what does spiritual malady mean? We've already looked at what does spiritual experience and spiritual awakening mean. Addiction is a problem. It's the problem that brings us into a 12-step program. A problem of the body and a problem of the mind. But as I mentioned, it's not the problem, it's a symptom of the problem. The real problem is the spiritual, is the spiritual malady. Let me see what we're doing here. It's a problem of the will power. It's a problem of the spirit. The problem of powerlessness. In the substance and process addiction, only 1 out of 10 people in North America are alcoholic. 9 out of 10 process alcohol quite readily. And about 5 out of 10 people are connected to that 1 out of 10 people. I don't know what the percentages are of addicts or gamblers or sex addicts or whatever, but it's a percentage, see? The reason that Bill was able to say in the first paragraph, in the first pref, in the first forward to the first edition, at the last line, our way of living may have its advantages for all, because unmanageability is the human condition. Unmanageability is the human condition. 100% of each human being has unmanageability, as at least I've understood the big book's description of unmanageability. So let's take a look at doctor's opinion. He talks a problem of the body, the problem being a physical defect that has an allergy. The sign of the allergy is the phenomenon of craving that leads to compulsion. He says the only conclusion is entire abstinence. Let's see what he has to say. I'm going to be looking at now the big book page by page, and I'll be just commenting on my highlights. We'll spend a couple weeks on Dr. Silkworth's opinion and this aspect of step one. Just for your purposes, assignment between now and next week, because I'll be unpacking next week some different material, is still with assignment 3 on the body, to read pages 17 to 23. That's number 3 in the assignment list. But I also have an additional assignment that came to me over the weekend as I was reviewing my notes. Because there's a wonderful description of progressive alcoholism. I believe it's in the chapter to the wives, pages 108 to 110. Pages 108 to 110. There's 4 different kinds of progressive deterioration of people with an alcohol problem. Read that for information, certainly, but also perhaps for identification. The assignment talks about looking at step one from the 12 and 12. You have a couple of weeks to review that. It might be interesting. We'll be in step one for at least a month, month and a half, 2 months, 3 months maybe, depending. And then for next week, take a look at the list of questions, 20 questions for addiction. Now, it's not the 20 questions that you're used to from one of the universities back 50 years ago. I've taken that and made it my own based on my knowledge and my experience and some other people's opinions about addiction. It has still the 20 questions, but they include drugs, alcohol, food, and behavior. So it includes all the substance and the process addictions. I believe it's on page 7 or 8, page 6, there it is. I have a note. Page 6. Take a look at that for identification purposes. Take it slowly. It's not a test to get correct. It's not a test to pass a percentage. No, it's a prompter for you to identify whether or not you have an addiction and whether or not it's the one you think you have. I'm saying in the set-aside attitude, if you're an alcoholic and you've got a year or 3 decades, it doesn't matter. Set it aside that you're an alcoholic. Are you? Or have you been misled all these years? Let's take a look at what does it mean to be an alcoholic? What does it mean to be an addict? And then take a look at and complete at some point, certainly before next Tuesday or thereafter, maybe over the next couple of weeks, the body worksheet on page 7 in the Way of Life document. So back to the doctor's opinion. The first question I ask people after they've read this and highlighted it, what's the doctor's opinion? And I get like a deer in headlights. it's the title of the chapter, Herb. Oh yeah, I know. But it is leading us to believe he has an opinion. Quite frankly, there's more than one opinion in it, but his primary opinion is what's up on the PowerPoint chart, that we have a disease. He was a pioneer, one of the first professionals to diagnose as a medical doctor that alcoholism is a disease, that there's something wrong with our bodies, that we have an allergy. What's an allergy? An abnormal reaction to a substance. That's the dictionary. An abnormal reaction to a substance. I'm allergic to fresh fruit, thin-skinned fresh fruit. How did I discover that? At age 30, I ate a fig. My eyes closed, my throat closed, I couldn't breathe, and I threw up. The next week, I washed it because I liked figs up till age 30. The second time I tried it, after washing it very thoroughly, my eyes closed, my throat closed, I couldn't breathe, and I threw up. I have not had a fig since, and I did not go to Figs Anonymous. I just had an experience that was awful, and I stopped. I have an allergy to cats. I don't have to know a cat's been in a room. I don't have to see a cat. I don't have to have pictures of a cat. If there's been a cat in the room, I will have an eye problem, watering, a throat problem, I can't breathe. And I'll be very uncomfortable. So I try to avoid being around cats. Not a problem for me. I didn't know that I didn't know at age 43, looking back over my shoulder at that point in the hospital when they asked me to do this autobiography of my relationship with alcohol, I was able to connect the dots. I've had 2 502s, drunk driving arrests, and a single car crash that put me in the hospital overnight with 48 stitches in my head due to alcohol. Well, those had all happened over increments of 5 years. I had never pieced them together until I did that. Once I start, I cannot stop. On Roman numeral 25, XXV, Bill, in writing this preface to the doctor's opinion, he said, this is going to be a medical estimate of the problem. He calls this book a plan of recovery. I love it that it's in blue. I relate it to a plan like an architectural plan, a blueprint. This is a textbook, as we saw from the Roman numerals. This has precise directions in it based on my experience, like a textbook does. And Bill calls it a plan of recovery, like a blueprint. At the beginning of the letter, Dr. Silkworth says, These alcoholics I've come to see are hopeless. He had a horrible experience with alcoholism. Nobody got well in Towns Hospital. They restored themselves a little bit. They rehabbed a little bit. They had lots of different kinds of treatment programs. The final time that Bill came in December of 1934, was his fourth hospitalization in 2 years. One in 1933 and three in 1934, September, November, and December. In the course of this third treatment, he got some ideas about a possible means of recovery. He's talking about the Oxford group. Now, here's the plan of recovery. He commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. The one thing I ask of you, when you complete, not if you complete, when you complete this workshop, is that you make a commitment to yourselves that you will help other people do this work, these steps out of this big book, so that they can find the freedom that you will inevitably find in December. Doesn't matter how long you've been sober and how many times you've done the steps, and even whether you've done the steps in a workshop or out of the big book before. Each time I did it, I had a new experience. Each time I did it, I broadened my ability to see that I don't see, and I deepened my relationship with the light. He uses the term at the end of that paragraph, recovered, as we did from the title page. I pointed out just because it's there, not because I have an edge about it, but I like people to understand that the big book talks about recovered. That's why it says in step 10, we're placed in a position of neutrality. Not an issue anymore. We're not fighting it. We have no inclination with regard to our addiction. We're placed in a position of neutrality. Hear the grace. We are placed. It's not because we did anything, although there are some preconditions. On page Roman numeral 26, XXVI, he calls it a remedy for thousands. And then it was a short letter. So Bill makes a comment because he asked him to write a longer letter later on, which is on the next page. But Bill comments, this is Bill's writing, about the doctor's opinion. He says that we must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. That is very logical for a psychiatrist to be talking about the mind underneath that psychiatry degree and experience and training is the medical training. So he's talking about the body. And then Bill, in his poetic style, captures. What does that mean? We're maladjusted to life, in full flight from reality, outright mental defectives. I know that doesn't apply to any of you. You're the paramount and the mecca of mental wellness and spirituality. That's why you're here. Our bodies are sickened as well. This is Bill's comments now. A physical factor. If you don't have that real understanding, your understanding of addiction is incomplete, he says. The doctor's theory is that we have an allergy. Well, it's a theory, it's not science. He's not doing a calibrated study. He's not doing a statistically significant conclusion here, as we would today, evidence-based. No, he's just processed hundreds of people. And he said, there's something wrong with you people. Once you start, you cannot stop. On Roman numeral 27, he talks about alcohol and drug addiction. Bill, in fact, had some drug problems, and you'll see that in his story. Maybe we'll get to it tonight, and maybe we won't. Dr. Bob clearly was a pill head. He wrote his own prescriptions. He was an alcoholic. But he used pills in order to be able to steady his hand so he could do surgery. I don't think I mentioned that Dr. Bob was a surgeon, medical doctor. He ran the practice in the hospital in Akron, Ohio. He was a very skilled and highly reputed medical doctor as well as surgeon. On Roman numeral 27, it says the doctor realized that some form of moral psychology, all right, he's a psychiatrist. He's talking about philosophy and psychology as it was known in the day, mostly based probably on Freud. But then he watches his language, because this is 1939 and he's a scientist. He's got to be careful about any connotation to spirituality, God, and things of immaterial. So he says the powers of good. That's a euphemism for God or a higher power. Synthetic knowledge. This is the knowledge we've acquired, learned by humans. We have ideas and we put them into practical application. See, knowledge is really important. As I didn't say when we saw the model of body, mind, and will, the mind is what makes us human. No other sentient reality has the ability to self-reflect, to know that they know, to stand outside themselves, to transcend themselves and watch themselves. No other sentient reality, to the best of our knowledge, has that ability. The other component that makes us specifically human is our willpower. There is no other sentient reality that has free choice. Now, the reason that the will is there under unmanageability is an indication that we don't have free choice in some areas. We certainly don't have free choice with regard to our addiction, but Bill speculates, and I'll show you, and you can make up your own mind about it, whether you have free choice with regard to managing your own lives successfully on your own power. To be free from physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure. Here he's using craving as the dictionary would use it. Craving is a desire for something, a feeling about wanting some relief. In the morning when I get up, in a mild way, I have a craving for a cup of coffee. I love my coffee. I have one cup of coffee. I don't have any more coffee after that. I don't want it. I don't need it. But when I first wake up, one of the first thoughts that I have is about brewing up the coffee. That's not the craving that Dr. Silkworth is talking about. He's using it here as the dictionary would use it. In the next line, he uses it the way I want you to hear it. And then make up your own mind as to whether my interpretation is accurate. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol, the action of whatever your addiction is, substance or process, is a manifestation of an allergy. When I eat figs, I can't breathe. When I'm around cats, I can't breathe. That's an allergy, an abnormal reaction to a substance. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class. He's using now a phrase unique to the big book, phenomenon of craving. Well, what does he mean by that? I'm keeping that as an open question right now, because I want you to see it from the context of the big book. Great phrase here. Frothy emotional appeal seldom helps, seldom suffices. Fear and anger and cajoling and parenting and police and employers. Frothy emotional appeal seldom helps. Sponsors, listen up. Don't be invested. Don't want it more than they want it. That was one of the cautions this man gave me that took me through the steps the first time. He said, Herb, I will work as hard as you do, but I won't work any harder. I hope you get it. I'm not invested in your success, and I'm not responsible for your failure. You are. This message that he delivered to me had depth and weight. I knew that when I first heard him for 5 minutes in a meeting. I had never heard anything or been attracted to anyone in the way that I was to him, because he was grounded in a power greater than himself and had recreated his life. Now I knew nothing about him other than the feelings I had, the magnetic force that pulled me in that direction. And it was a very unique experience. At the very bottom of that page, Bill said, Dr. Sukwar says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Some people tell me they don't like the taste. Well, I never met an alcohol I didn't like the taste of. But I really drank for the effect, the sense of relief. That one drink, that first drink was like, oh, I can breathe. At a conference or at lunch with a client or at a dance or at a social event or at a party or even at home, the tensions were just that first drink. It was magical. And it was magical on February 20th. I had my last drink on February 20th. I took my boss to the airport. We had a drink before he took off. Then I picked up the kids and I went to the hospital. That might have been the reason they asked me to stop drinking. They could smell it. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, I never did, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. And I could never have understood that until actually I did this work at 4 years of sobriety. I didn't know that I didn't know, and I had not connected the dots. Even in 4 years of sobriety, I thought I was an alcoholic because of the drama that I gave you the shortened version of a little bit earlier. 502s and drunk driving accidents and blackouts and problems at home and problems at work. I thought I was an alcoholic because of problems. No, anybody who overuses anything will have problems. My alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. And here's a wonderful line that we use, especially in unmanageability. Restless, irritable, and discontent. The tension in our lives is why we use the addiction to narcotize that tension, to ease that tension so that we can feel nothing or we can feel good. Everything's better than feeling that tension. And alcohol gives us a sense of ease and comfort. I've had a sense of ease and comfort since I did this work in 1988, 4 years sober. Up till then, I was still restless, irritable, and discontent for 4 years without alcohol because I hadn't replaced it with a relationship with power, a conscious, authentic, effective relationship with power. And then it was very mild, but it began the process, as I mentioned, three different journeys through the steps over the next few years. After they, now here's the doctor's use of the phenomenon of craving phrase. After they have succumbed to the desire again to have a drink, the phenomenon of craving develops. Do you hear the sequence here? There's no craving here until after this person he's referring to takes a drink. So he's not talking about the craving from the dictionary. He's not talking about the emotional. He's not talking about the desire for. He's not talking about the habit of. He's not talking of the want for. He's saying this person has taken a drink. Then the phenomenon of craving develops. So my understanding, it's not phrased this way in the big book, but that it's a biological problem, that it's a chemical problem. When I put the chemistry of alcohol into the chemistry of my body, it mixes in such a way that a trigger is pulled and a new substance is developed. It appears from some of the stuff I've read that the liver produces acetone. And when the acetone gets into the cellular structure demands more acetone. I'm not sure it's true, but it sounds great. It explains that chemical trigger. Once I take a drink intending to have two, I will have 22. The problem that masked itself for me was that it didn't happen every time. I call myself a periodic alcoholic. Every bit as an alcoholic, my wife was a chronic alcoholic, especially the last 10 years. She had to drink every day. And every time she drank every day, she got drunk and passed out. I just thought that was a disgusting lack of self-worth and self-care. He said from his high chair. This is repeated over and over until there is an entire psychic change. This is the whole point of spiritual awakening, that psychic change that puts us in a position of neutrality. Once that has occurred, I'm easily able to control my desire for alcohol. In fact, I have none and haven't had one since February 21st, 1984. The only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Oh, we're not cured. We have a daily reprieve because our life is unmanageable. We have a spiritual malady. None of that's here, but that is certainly my summary of my experience. At the very bottom, if you have any doubt about my interpretation, the last three lines. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount. The sequencing is critical here. Most people don't diagnose it probably as carefully as I am doing, but it's really important that you know this one of the two components. There are two components that make me an addict. The one is when I start, I cannot stop. The other is when I stop, I cannot stay stuck. The first is the problem of the body. The second is the problem of the mind. We're focused on the problem of the body. Let's stay there. Once I start, I cannot stop. The problem with me is I could go to lunch and have a drink and go back to work. I could have a couple drinks after work with the guys and then go home. I could have a drink when I got home and have dinner. I could go a day, a week, a weekend, a month without a drink if I had a good reason to do that. Not a problem. But I always started again, and that was the problem. I did have the body problem. I did have the craving problem, but it was periodic. As I said, it becomes more elusive then. These men were not drinking to escape. Oh, page Roman numeral 30. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. That's not poetry. This is the doctor's opinion. This is a medical diagnosis. He's saying it's not a mental control. It's not an emotional issue. It's not a willpower issue. It's not a knowledge issue. It's a biological issue. The phenomenon of craving is so ruthless that some commit the supreme sacrifice. I believe that's suicide. He gives us many different types of alcoholics here, the psychopaths, the emotionally unstable, unwilling to admit, the delusional person and the manic depressive. He doesn't make any comment about that. Because what he's really interested in is the next line, this fifth example, the types that are entirely normal. I put myself in that category, entirely normal in every respect, except the effect alcohol had upon them. There's one symptom. Here it is now. The doctor's opinion. No choice. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This is not a thought, this is not a feeling, this is not an emotion. The phenomenon of craving is a biological mandate, a biological imperative. Once I pour black ink into an 8-ounce glass of clear water, I will have black water. The mental image is startling and yet totally revealing of what we're talking about here. Once you start, you cannot stop. What's your experience? Look at your history. Do a bullet point autobiography like I did. If you have any doubt about your particular addiction or about any particular behavior, substance or process, this phenomenon may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been by any treatment which our familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have is entire abstinence. Most chronic alcoholics are doomed, hopeless. And you've heard the statement, I'm not sure exactly what it would be called. What happens to a cucumber when you put it in a quart of brine? After a while, it becomes a pickle. How soon after you take the pickle out of the brine, put it on the windowsill in the sunshine, does it restore itself to becoming a cucumber? Yeah, that would be never. Once a pickle, always a pickle. They said that in the hospital. I mean, they have to speak that way to us, knuckleheads. But I've never forgotten it. What an image. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic at 12 years old when I took my first drink. A story for a different day. But I lost control immediately, and I drank like that for the next 30 years. My wife was not. She didn't. She's a good Catholic Irish girl from Chicago. She didn't drink. She was 21. She had taken the pledge. She began drinking. We met. We had that in common. She never had a problem with it until she was probably 30, 35 years old. And then she crossed that invisible line. Not my experience. My first drink was the invisible line. But she progressively then became a chronic alcoholic, where I had been a periodic alcoholic right from the get-go. What is the solution? So maybe phenomenon of craving is a doctor's opinion, but maybe he has another opinion. Listen to this. About a year ago, I met this guy. Everything looked good, but he was an alcoholic. I'm summarizing Roman numeral 31. He was hopeless, it says, no hope, but he accepted the plan outlined in this book and he completely changed. Oh, that's an opinion from his observation. And then he gives us a second story. Another hopeless situation hiding in a barn. He says, maybe moral psychology would help, but I doubt it. See, he's a psychiatrist trying to help this guy. And on the next page, Roman numeral 32, he said, this guy became sold on the ideas contained in this book. Look at that final paragraph. Another doctor's opinion. Read the book and remain to pray. Very brave of him. I'm not sure that might not have been added later. What you may or may not know is that in the first edition, and for very many printings of the first edition, Dr. Silkworth never put his name on his letter. You can go and see it. In the first edition, page one started with the doctor's opinion. And then once Bill wanted to print the big book again in 1941, he had the insight that perhaps only alcoholics should write the material that's in the textbook. And so he put the doctor's opinion in Roman numerals. At that point, the doctor was willing to sign it because it had become rather accepted, Alcoholics Anonymous, as well as his medical association had accepted the alcoholism as a disease. So as you can see from the PowerPoint, there's only two important issues here with the doctor's opinion. His formal opinion based on the letter is that we have an allergy. It's a metaphor. It's not science. It's just an abnormal reaction to a substance. Abnormal meaning normal people don't have the reaction to alcohol. Normal people don't have the addiction compulsion with regard to drugs. Normal people don't have the addiction compulsion with regard to food or pornography or sex or relationships or anger or fear or gambling or work or exercise. Those are all addictions. An addiction, repetitive behavior over which we have no control, which leads to negative consequences. My definitions, not official. But the real key to the doctor's opinion is his definition, his very unique use of the word craving. He doesn't mean it mentally. He doesn't mean it emotionally. He doesn't mean it even sensually in the body. He is referring to a cellular chemical reaction to the chemistry of alcohol or the chemistry of drugs. Or the chemistry in food. I don't know the biology of it. He's talking about the phenomena of it. An observable phenomena means an observable scientific evaluation, evidence. Once I take a drink, I will inevitably take another. And if not that day, maybe the next day. And there's where some confusion might come in. Let's take a quick look at Bill's story, because that was part of my suggested reading. I asked you to look at pages 1-8 because it's Bill's story of his disintegration due to alcohol, that progressive deterioration in his life due to his progressive relationship with compulsive drinking. And you can see that on the first page, his grandfather, the person who raised him, his mother's father, had warned him, "We got problems in our family with alcohol." In fact, that was probably the problem with his own dad. Bill's own dad was probably an alcoholic. Strong warnings and prejudices of my people. But Bill had an inferiority complex. It's very clear from reading his biographies and autobiographies. I fancied myself a leader as an, quite frankly, armchair psychology. He was overcompensating for his awkwardness and for his sense of inferiority. His mother and his father both left when he was 12 or 13. And left him with the mother's father. So he, by today's standards, has serious abandonment issues, of course. It's related that in high school, he had no musical talent, but he was so aggressive and dedicated fiercely that he learned an instrument and became a leader of the band. He had no athletic ability. He was very long, tall, ungainly, awkward. And yet he became captain of the football team and the baseball team. He had this tremendous drive to be number one. And I'm quoting him. The head of vast enterprises. You can just see and feel the grandiosity of the ego there. Well, during his stint in the service, he got unleashed into alcohol through parties and going overseas. And when he came back, his problems were connected to alcohol. He went to school because he wanted to succeed. Law school, he finished law school, barely. He passed the exams barely. He was drunk when he was there, but he got out somehow with a certificate that he had completed his law degree. He'd never sat for the bar because he got interested in Wall Street. And of course, this is the roaring 20s. And he and Lois couldn't get any real traction in the city. This is how entrepreneurial and inventive and creative he was, way ahead of his time. He said, well, if I go to where they're making stuff, the factories, I can find out what's on the market for next year and what might be successful, and we can invest in those companies before anybody knows about it. And he would send reports back to Wall Street, and he became really rich, a millionaire actually, as a result of getting paid for his information, but also because he was able to purchase stocks at a very low price, and the market was really crazy in the sense of going up rather rapidly. So he and Lois took off to motorbike around the countryside. Now, these are not Harley Davidsons of today and the wonderful quality motorcycles that you see on the road. These are mechanical rattle traps that spurt oil all over the place and the parts fall off. But he and Lois take a motorcycle with a sidecar. And if you've seen the picture, it's funny as heck. Bill's in the sidecar, Lois is driving. That'll tell you something about her. She's an in-charge woman, and she's taking her boy out to the East Coast to make some money. Amazing story, it's a wonderful story. And he did, page three. He was so good that, in fact, he was able to play golf most of the days, but that was because he liked to drink, it says. He became jittery in the morning. It's beginning to affect him now. The stock market crashes and Bill's problems and his drinking crashed and he got fired. But he still got his thing together, so he goes to Montreal, Eastern Canada, gets another job and gets fired. And he wasn't employed again for another 5 years. Hear the deterioration, the progressive deterioration. Read the story from the point of view of identification. What did he think like? What did he feel like? What did he act like? How did he drink? What was the outcome? And try to compare by identification, not by difference. Because obviously there's a lot of differences. But the dynamic of the way he thought, the way he felt, the way he acted, and the way he drank. Liquor ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. He's drinking bathtub gin, this stuff will really kill you. I thought I could control it. There were periods of sobriety. Gradually things got worse. They lost the house, they lost the job. He says at the bottom of page five, I saw that I could not take so much as a drink. I made lots of promises. The Bible in his home in New York has 12 dated entries of his promise to Lois of quitting, signed and dated. He was very sincere, and each time he came home drunk, no fight, whatever. Was I crazy? Bill's beginning to tell us what he means by insanity here. Look at the definition embedded in this sentence. An appalling lack of perspective. He's not talking about psychiatric. He's not talking about psychological. An appalling lack of perspective. There's something, a problem with the way he thinks. He has a mental defect. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness, page six. A terrible sense of impending calamity. I thought of suicide. But the mental fog settled down, gin. A lot of geographics there on page seven. A lot of drugs, gin, and sedatives from the doctor. His brother-in-law happened to be, Lois's brother, was a physician. Lois's brother was the one that got him in Towns Hospital in September, in 1933. I'm not sure exactly the month. but then got him back in the hospital three times in 1934. He was trying to get sober. He went to Dr. Silkworth. He went to Towns Hospital. 1933, once. September, November of 1934. Armistice Day, that's the Veterans Day by our standards, the celebration of, at that time, the end of World War I. Self-knowledge would fix it, he said, coming out. I now know myself better. And he drank again. He talks about a ski jump. Hear the deterioration and the pace of it. It's a wonderful mental image. I returned to the hospital. And he hears in November, he hears from the doctor outside the room talking to Lois that he's going to die, or he's going to go into an asylum with a wet brain. That means a brain so saturated with alcohol that you lose any awareness of reality. And probably the eventual loss of your motor functions and then eventual loss of your life. He knew that. Undertaker or asylum, a devastating blow to my pride. You see, he's hopeless and he's helpless. Cornered at last. But he drank again. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. This is Bill's bottom here on page 8. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. He's a poet, but try to imagine it. You're out in the Mojave Desert. For you not in California, that's a very large desert in the middle of California. And assume that you're there in the middle of the desert alone and on the sand, and that sand's all quicksand. And any direction you go, you're going to sink in up to your thighs. But you gotta pull your leg out and go forward someplace in order to save your life. Man, that's an image of how we were stuck in our addiction, or still are, if in fact you're here because you are still having a problem with some form of substance or process addiction. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. The word surrender is not in the big book. It certainly doesn't apply to step 3, as I'll make very clear when we get there. But it certainly applies here. Complete defeat. This is where Bill is now coming to a place of his bottom. This is where Bill is finally surrendering. He stepped from the hospital, a broken man, Armistice Day, his last debauch. But now he's writing this in 1938, preparing for the big book. And he can say, in retrospect, I was catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension. In a different place, I believe it's on page 25, he talks about rocketed into a fourth dimension. It's the same image, catapulted into the fourth dimension. That fourth dimension being the world of the spirit, the invisible, the immaterial. And I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness. He's sitting, writing this in 1938. He's 4 years sober. Happiness, peace, and usefulness. A way of life, he calls it here. That phrase, as I've mentioned, is used 20 times with regard to 10, 11, and 12. We'll stop there. Because the rest is his being brought out of the ditch, out of the darkness into the light. The next 8 pages will talk about his rehabilitation. And we'll look at that when we come to step 2. So let's have some conversation from you.
So my question is also, I'm wanting your comments on the growth in the program. I'm experiencing a new relationship with the word powerlessness.
All right.
And it's now, in the beginning, it was more about being powerless over behaviors. But as you know, I grow in sobriety, it's seeming like, is the powerlessness the awareness of knowing that you can always go back and that there's like a need always for God? Because I'm seeing that, you know, the spiritual practices that we are doing, the meditation, prayer, and all those things, it seems like they slack up once I feel like, I got a handle. And is the having feeling that you have a handle, I think that that's a sneaky, like I'm suspicious of that feeling. And you'll tell us like, feelings are not to be trusted. And so I'm looking into powerlessness to define what that feels like in my body, in my being, in the presence of like me being aware of myself. What does powerlessness show up like now? Is it just a thought? Is it just a need?
So you so much want to see powerless correctly so that you can control it. What? Did you hear yourself?
You're right.
All right. So try no choice.
No choice. Okay.
And what we're talking about here is the first part of the first half of the first step.
Mm-hmm.
Body and mind is the first half.
Mm-hmm.
And we're only looking at half of that, the right. Body part.
Okay.
So what's your experience with addiction when you start?
I don't stop.
You got all. It. That's right. It. Why not? You're smart. You have willpower. Why don't you? You suffer. You don't want to suffer. Why don't you stop? I want an answer. Oh. I want an answer.
Right.
That wasn't a rhetorical question.
Oh, okay.
Why don't you stop?
You want me to answer that, right?
I do.
Because I feel like I gave up, and what difference does it make?
Uh-huh. See, you think it's a thought.
Mm-hmm.
You think it's a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You've missed my entire lecture.
Did I miss it, or am I just rejecting it?
Well, I don't know. It sounded to me like you missed it, because that point that you just made is a point of the problem of the mind, not a problem of the body. Tell me, what 12-step program are you in?
SLAW.
Say it again, SLAW.
SLAW.
Right. And so what would be evidence that you have relapsed? What would be evidence of that? I'm not saying that you have. Just saying, what would be evidence that you relapsed?
Obsessing over an ex and stalking him online.
All right. So in abstinence, you don't go into obsession about a relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever relapsed into an obsession?
Yes.
All right. And how much control did you have over once you began obsessing?
None.
Why not? You're intelligent. You don't want to suffer. You know that the consequences are going to be negative. Why don't you just stop when you start?
Well, it makes sense to me at the time. It makes sense at the time. You're right. I get it. I need to sit with that, Herb. I'm going to. Well,
here's a picture.
Okay.
8 ounces of clear water. Bottle of ink. I pour the ink into the water. What happens?
It becomes colored like the ink.
There it is. That's the chemical analogy, similar to when you engage in the obsession, that first engagement, you're lost. You're hijacked.
Mm-hmm.
When I take a drink of whiskey, intending to have two, I will have 22. I didn't intend to do that. I have every reason not to do that. I need to go back to work, or I need to go home. And yet I do it. And I did it for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it happened every time, all right, that I lost control. The real question is, how come I didn't see it for 30 years? That's a mind problem.
Mm-hmm.
The body problem is that it happens. It's not about thought. It's not about feeling. This is a wonderful teaching moment for everybody to really capture the essence of this. It's a physical dynamic, not a mental or emotional dynamic. That's why I say it's biological mandate, biological imperative. It's a physiological trigger chemical reaction, even for process addiction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and that's what I want to hear more about. The people in process addiction talk about what is the parallel language that we can use. That's why I asked.
Right. And I think the way that you are dissecting it into the three is opening a whole new avenue for me. So I'm not as articulate with it because I hear what you're saying. I do, but I don't have the filters yet to give it back to you.
Yep.
But I feel the resistance of what you're saying tapping on something that I believe or that I do or that I'm, you know, that I use.
So go deeper and get out of the mind and the feelings and go just watch your behavior. What do you do when you first engage where you lose control? What do you do? I engage and I lose control. I engage and I lose control. Mm-hmm. I engage and I lose control. Oh my God, I don't have any control. We call that no choice. We call that powerless.
Okay. Now I see. Yeah. Now I see where that is, because before 5 minutes ago, I was still trying to, you see what I was trying to do.
You're trying to understand it and see that it was rational or emotional or manageable by understanding it. I can get a handle on it.
Right.
And no, I have to, I want you to understand the chemical formula.
Yes. Got it.
Yeah.
And it's like, no matter how long you've been doing this, for me, no matter how long I've been doing this process, when you get to step one, my brains keep going, is it, because that's my, and also as a codependent, it's that bent towards, I gotta figure it out. If I could just figure it out.
Yeah.
Right.
But you are figuring it out.
Right.
See, in this conversation, you're figuring it out through an experience, not through an understanding, not through a feeling, but you look at your behavior and is, when I start, I cannot stop. Mm-hmm. When I start, I cannot stop. Well, you have to challenge, is that your experience? I do not stop. Is it because I chose not to stop? Or is it because I couldn't stop? Good. Another question. No. So think about that. And that's the benefit of looking at the addiction questionnaire, the 20 questions, as well as the body worksheet, because it invites you to look at your actual behavior, not mine, not my stories, not the big books, but your actual behavior. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I just had a question. I think you've told us that you were healed of the drinking problem before you started the 12-step program.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm curious about what motivated you to attend a meeting a day and call your sponsor.
No. I didn't go to AA. I see what you're saying. I'm sorry. You better finish your question rather than me anticipate your question.
Okay. I'm just wondering if you were aware that you were spiritually sick, even though you weren't drinking any longer.
Oh no.
What motivated you to do this daily work?
That's a really good question, actually. At some point, the hospital, when I was talking about my history and I read that autobiography out loud, they said, you might want to try AA. Very gentle. And I thought, okay, one of my best friends was in AA. So I had been to one or two meetings with him because he said he wanted me to see what he was doing. That was his manipulative way of getting me into a meeting. It didn't take because I didn't hear anything. But so they said, I was, again, the word was willingness. I was willing to take direction from the hospital to go to a meeting, and I enjoyed the meeting, because it was like group therapy. And I had been very oriented towards psychology. And I kept going back once a week. And when I heard a lot of their sharing and identified with their alcoholism and the hospital teaching about the nature of the disease, all of that came together. And I said, okay, I'm an alcoholic. And they had said, alcoholics go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And somehow I was willing to do that.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, because it felt good.
Okay.
No, that's the answer to the question. I wouldn't have done it if it didn't feel good. It felt good to go there and have a place of support and a place to talk and to also hear stuff that was very, you know, spiritual and deep. And that was my inclination anyway. No, I haven't thought about it from that angle. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So last time we met, you talked about being rocketed into the fourth dimension, and you mentioned width, height, and depth.
Yes, that's the three dimensions. You're right.
The three dimensions. And you said the fourth one was time.
No, I didn't say that. Einstein did.
Oh, okay.
I was quoting Einstein. I said Bill didn't know about Einstein's theory at the time. So when he used fourth dimension, he was really talking about the spiritual dimension, even though Einstein's theory says that, or speculates theory, that's the fourth dimension. That I was making a distinction, and I'm sorry I confused you.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Does that help?
That helps. I mean, I was kind of, my sense was that it was talking about the quantum leap that happens in our hearts and minds when we do this kind of work. So I figured that's where it was going.
Stay with the poetry. It's wonderful.
All right. Thank you.
It's great. I am asking a question about last week's assignment about the principles.
Okay.
I am very stuck on trust.
Okay.
I just don't trust God. I don't trust it.
All right. Yeah. All right. Trust this process. Trust the big book. If you want to trust me, I suggest it. If you can bring yourself to that, and then wait until we finish step three. That's my dialogue for you who just asked your question.
So someone has asked me to take them through the steps on a one-on-one basis.
Yeah.
And I want to say yes. In fact, I already said yes. And then I'm like, how do I know how to do this? I mean, like, who do I think I know? You know, it's like, wait a minute.
Have you been through the steps?
Yes, a couple of times.
All right. Well, why don't you share with them what you've done?
Okay.
Yeah.
I can do that. But I was wondering if you had a recommendation on using your way of life. I did work the steps once with that one. No.
Oh, you did? You say?
I did.
With one of my year-long processes?
Yes, I did it with a small group. I didn't actually do it with you there. We used your videos, your tapes. We listened to your tapes.
Share what you know. Share what your experience is. Share what your assignments have been. Don't try to be me.
Okay.
Don't try to do it academically. Do it just from your heart, what you did.
Just my experience.
Yeah, okay. And maybe as you're developing new experiences, you can share that too.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And the timeline, do I let it be on her timeline?
In contrast to what?
Me setting a timeline.
Why would you do that?
I don't want to. Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah. On her timeline. Okay, good. Yeah.
It's not your program. It's her program.
That's right. That's right.
What you do is you give her the assignments, and then when she's done, you can work with her when she's finished the assignment. So I don't have a time frame.
Perfect. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Good.
What was your experience being an sober alcoholic and having a wife in recovery?
Yeah,
what was that experience like to you? I mean, I understand small version of it, but how did you manage that?
What was to manage? I mean, it was wonderful. She had the same time I did, a little bit ahead of me. we were going to meetings. We each had a sponsor. We were talking the talk. We were sharing the path, and we required our three adult, our three children at the time, not adult, our children, to go to Alateen. And for whatever reason, they did. And so we had a family in recovery that was very busy and talking good stuff and in therapy individual and in therapy as groups and in family therapy. And in, Jesus, it was like going on.
You give us these little snippets of your life and the times and it, you know, trying to piece it all together. But yeah, as you said, it worked, and it worked well.
Yeah, it was a wonderful foundation. I now have a daughter 30 years in AA and another one 30 years in Al-Anon. And my son has absorbed some of it, but he doesn't seem to have any issues.
What I love that you said tonight was about the will, the issue of the will. I did what I didn't want to do, and I didn't do what I wanted to do. And to me that, you know, at 28 years of sobriety, I'll be 29 in May if I make it. That to me is sort of a caption,
yes,
of like the last decade in a way. And I don't want to live that way anymore, especially after all the sobriety. No. I didn't get sober for this, you know what I mean?
I do, very much so. And be patient with it, but given the awareness that you have, a consciousness and ability to articulate it right now, I'm anticipating you having a very big experience with unmanageability in terms of as I'll introduce it.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to share that tonight. Thanks for
this. I'm so glad you did. And, you know, plug in, give us reports on it, because it's not necessarily will I remember to call on you or to ask you, if even if you share. So take the initiative. And now that you've established yourself with us, plug in and keep the story moving along as you move along.
Aye, aye, Captain. Thanks.
Oh, I like your attitude. You're going to do real well.
Hi. Yeah, so I'm reading in the doctor's opinion, and I had a similar experience when I got sober. I was a garbage man in San Francisco. They had fired me for missing work, and they told me to go, you know, go to talk to somebody, and they sent me to AA to get my little paper signed. And my motivation was really, well, okay, I'm just going to do this to get my job back, and, you know, and by some grace, I was able to do that. But when I read the doctor's opinion, and I ran and got a big book before that because I was a heavy periodic, and it just, you know, it doesn't make sense when you read it to an alcoholic of my type there. You know, yes, it makes sense, but there's some kind of thing, it's not logical where I just go, oh, I'm sick and I need to go get help. Right. And I just wanted to see if you could expand on that and the last sentence of the Silkworth where I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book, though perhaps he may came to scoff, he may remain to pray. Yeah. And I just feel like there was a grace in somehow,
yeah,
you know, in somehow like what happened to me. So
yeah, well, and that's exactly what he's sort of intimating it there gently, that read the book. But the knowledge that you get from the book is not going to really help you, other than if you see that the knowledge in the book says that you can't help yourself, you're hopeless and doomed unless you find a power other than yourself. So you may scoff at the knowledge, but remain and pray despite your resistance. So that's my interpretation of that. He's trying to say, as a scientist himself, a medical doctor that is a psychoanalyst, I'm sort of giving you a kind of a gentle push toward a power other than yourself. That's what he's saying by the pray word, because he hasn't used very many words in the opinion concerning God or spirituality. So in fact, he dodges them with some type of euphemisms, but he gets very clear at the bottom. And that's why I say that may be another one of his opinions. Yeah.
Thanks, John. Hi, my question is about what you said, the craving and developing biological problem. If like for instance, your craving about the coffee, was it, which you said, am I correct or not?
Well, I use the term craving two different ways. When I introduced the term, I talked about it from a dictionary standpoint, like the craving for coffee. That's the common use of the term in most people's vocabulary. Making the distinction that the big book has a very, 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 very different and unique definition of craving.
Is it the craving of being a habit of doing it would be the definition? No.
No, in the big book, the word craving is a biological reaction. I'm using my terms to try to give an emphasis to the uniqueness of the word in the big book.
Okay, thank you. So I got it. The big book, the biological process is the definition.
That's Herb's opinion. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I got my question and you answered me. Thank you.
I guess my question is, I love the position that the sponsee is responsible for their time frame, right, for their recovery. What responsibility then is there as a sponsor to push that person in what way? Because I came in knowing, okay.
No pushing, sorry.
Because you hear the old timers or the people who tell, like, my sponsor said this, do 50 push-ups in front of the judge, and I don't know, you know?
Great, good.
That's not my style.
Not my philosophy, not okay. My style. Yeah,
not my style either. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, well, because of the people that were in my life, they gave me suggestions, and there were no consequences from them to me.
Yeah.
If I followed it or if I didn't follow it, there were consequences to me from me.
Yes.
And every one of them let me have my own experience.
Right.
Yeah. Now, there are some people, and obviously there's no right or wrong answer here. There are some people that need a little bit more parenting in the beginning because they've never been parented and they really have awful, unhealthy habits. So we can make strong suggestions. I know my daughter in AA, she has a strict regimen of call times for her sponsees. You call me at 7:00. If it's 7:01, I won't answer the phone. All right. So I don't agree with it, but that's her style of sponsoring.
Okay. Yeah. Because it didn't work for me, right? The rigidity didn't, I needed it to be my idea, especially in the beginning. But I also don't want to sponsor my experience needs to be everyone else's experience. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But this answers for me. You know what I mean? It helps.
If anybody wants to do a little more digging on or reading or reflecting on sponsorship, that book by Hamilton B. out of Hazleton. There you go. That one. Have you begun reading it?
Just only slightly.
All right. It's a simple book, but it's just very experiential. And I read it 3 times because I've done workshops and I refresh my on his own take on it. And I've never once found anything that I would disagree with in the book.
Okay, great.
That's why I like it.
Great. I just don't want to mess anyone up, you know? I'm just joking.
If your intention is, no, I get it. But have the intention of helping. Then all of our behavior will come out of that.
Okay.
I just started to feel like I couldn't hold the mask on anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was just me becoming aware of a form of powerlessness.
It sounds to me like it's you having an experience of the emergence of your true self, which is, I believe, authentic spiritual growth. And it cracks the shell that contains us. So whatever it is, it sounds healthy to me. Just whatever you're doing to foster that, continue. Okay. Yeah, and that's what this work will do when we get into the fourth step. It will put it on steroids.
Well, even then, I felt like it hurt to the touch, you know, like it was very tender and emotional.
Yes, you've created it as a survival protection. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when it begins to disintegrate, there is a sense of loss and maybe of even some fear. So how do I, please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.